This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a problem in New York State and around the country, prisoners aging behind bars.
There are over 9,000 elderly prisoners in New York State, purely for punishment. What kind of society is this?
Raymond Nat Turner is the poet in residence at Black Agenda Report. He'll join us to talk about his politics and art.
And we're going to ask him to read a poem for us.
We'll get an update on new developments in Chicago from Flint Taylor.
The movement is on the move. Last week, it forced Mayor Rahm Emanuel to throw his superintendent of police, Gary McCarthy, under the bus. But it's a big bus with plenty of room underneath.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Mujahid Farid spent 33 years in prison, where he was a successful jailhouse lawyer. He is now involved in the leadership of RAP, Release Aging People in Prison, and has been the organizer of much of the legal response to parole board intransigence. RAP activists are pushing the parole board to apply the law regarding hearings using recognized standards to measure whether an applicant would be a risk to public safety if he or she were released, rather than their current policy of simply reciting, you have to stay in prison because of the nature of your crime. Laura Whitehorn, our other guest, is a former political prisoner and a native New Yorker who was active in supporting the Black Panther Party and active in Students for Democratic Society. Laura worked to help expose the FBI's counterintelligence program.
Mujahid and Laura, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
And thanks for the invitation.
I wanted to start, if you would, Mujahid, by briefly telling us your personal story of how you were incarcerated and from how many years and what happened.
Okay. I'll start from maybe the time of my arrest. I was arrested in 1978 for a homicide and an attempt murder on a police officer. Actually, the attempt murder on the police officer was something that was tagged on afterwards, after the arrest. I got into a scuffle outside of a discotheque that they had at that time. And during the course of the fight, I shot one of the individuals that I was in the scuffle with. Towards the end of the fight, as I was trying to exit the scene, I heard a shot behind my back. I turned around to see exactly, you know, what was going on. And I couldn't discern because there was so much chaos, large crowd out there, everybody ripping and running. So I proceeded, and a few blocks away, I got cordoned off and arrested. Later on, as they processed the charges against me, I learned that the shot that occurred behind me was a plainclothes police officer. And then he claimed that I actually turned around and tried to fire my weapon at him. He says that he heard a click during this chaos. And that then after the click, I proceeded to run again. He pretty much added that part in. I went to trial. I actually wasn't convicted of the person I killed. I had a justification defense. But I was convicted of the attempt on the police officer. An attempt at that time of a police officer carried the same penalty as completing the act. So the least I could have gotten for that conviction was 15 years to life, which was what the judge gave me. I proceeded. I entered the system. I didn't expect to serve the time, I mean, because I always... My line was always, how is it possible to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt that never happened? I mean, I thought that was an impossibility, and I thought I would get it a reversal. And so I began entrenching myself in the law almost from day one. and working at getting that reversal. That didn't happen. But during the course of my serving the time, one of the things I also did was to tell myself that I shouldn't waste a day that I'm in this system, that I should try to take advantage of all of my time and try to turn it around and get some benefit out of it.
Well, let's talk about what you did, because it turned out 15 years to life turned out to be 33 years.
That's right.
And how many denials of parole?
Nine denials. I was released at the 10th board.
Whoa. Well, but in the interim, you're in prison. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what you did. How many college degrees did you get?
I got actually 4 degrees, from associate's, bachelor's, to 2 graduate degrees.
And were you involved in any programs helping prisoners?
Quite a few programs. I actually was involved in creating certain programs, stellar programs that still exist today.
Really? What programs?
Well, one of them is called PACE, Prisoners, AIDS, Counseling, and Education. And it grew out of something that we actually started in Auburn called PEPA. The idea came out of Auburn. A small crew of us brainstormed the PEPA program and pretty much got disbanded by transferring all of us throughout the state. But when I wound up at another facility, we continued to work, and PACE got established and pretty much is still doing the work.
Let's talk about the parole system, because we want to talk about how it really doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And the situation of huge population of elderly people in prison as a consequence. You came up for parole how many times?
10 times. I made the 10th parole board, and that's like every 2 years.
And tell us what it's like to prepare, and who do you talk to, and what do you say? I mean, what does one do to try to get out on parole?
And do you have witnesses there who speak on your behalf?
No, there's no one that appears on your behalf at the parole board. You can't have legal representation there. You're on your own, and they pretty much very fast proceedings. On average, I would say, especially from someone that was situated as I was, they last about 4 to 5 minutes.
After 2 years. And do you actually speak with these people in person, or is it?
When I originally started going, they were live personal interviews. And I think my first 3 or 4 parole boards were those type of hearings. And then they switched to using teleconference.
And what made the difference on that final appearance?
Now, that's a long story, but a lot of things went on between that 9th and 10th parole boards. But I'm going to point to the major difference as a parole commissioner that was on that board. It was a former nun, and she was known. She bucked the system for a while, for the brief period that she was on the parole board. And I happened to get her at that last board.
Mujahid, let me ask you this. It seems to me what a parole board should do is look at the prisoner as he or she is now, not mm-hmm. what she was then, mm-hmm. but allowing for people to change mm-hmm. and improve themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole concept of parole, I think.
Yeah, I do too. But it seems to me that instead of that, there's a stigma. They say once a criminal, always a criminal, and they keep you in there because of the crime you committed many years ago. Was that your experience?
Yeah, what happened was, my experience was that over time, as this punishment paradigm began to take root in the society, that the parole boards were co-opted into that process.
You know, we say the parole system is broken. It's broken from the standpoint of justice. It's broken from the standpoint of public safety, because the decisions of the parole board are based on revenge, and as you said, going back 40 years in some cases to what someone did when they were 19 or 20 years old, not looking at them now. And so in terms of public safety, the people that are being denied pose the lowest risk to public safety. However, if you look at it from the standpoint of carrying out a system of revenge against, primarily against black people and other people of color, then the parole board works because it keeps people in over and over again, denies them their humanity. So we're talking about changing the parole process so that it meets its original purpose that one would imagine it would have, which is to judge, are you now the same person you were? Will you lead a law-abiding, constructive life? And Fareed and I worked with a lot of people who are examples of how you can lead not only a law-abiding life, but a creative one and contribute to a community. And the people we're concerned about through RAP are exactly those people.
And as the prison population gets older, the longer people are incarcerated, obviously this is becoming a larger problem of so many elder people behind bars.
In New York State right now, more than 17% of the incarcerated population are people over the age of 50. And we use the age of 50 because people age faster in prison because of the conditions, the stress. How many individuals? Something like, what is it, 9,300, something like that?
Close to that. Yes.
And of those, two-thirds have parole-eligible sentences, so they could be let out. And of those, over 100 have been denied for 20 years or more. That's every 2 years for 20 years. And something like 370 have been denied every year for more than 10 years.
So when you talk about objective standards, what are we talking about? What would you like to have these parole boards confine themselves to?
Our slogan, I think, spells that out completely. We're saying, our slogan is, if the risk is low, let them go. And, of course, that can apply across the board on the age scale. But we know for sure that we use it because the population that we are focusing on, almost to a person, score low risk for committing a crime upon release or recidivating.
What kinds of challenges, if any, have been brought in the courts in New York State against this system?
There's quite a few challenges going on, and we're trying to develop one of them into some of our strategizing, our organizing. And what that entails is that recently some courts have held the parole board in contempt for refusing to engage in a forward-looking process when they conduct these hearings. There's a lot of stuff that's behind that also. I think I need to say that historically there's been this position that the courts don't have the power to order a person's release, that all they can do is to order a new hearing, a de novo hearing for an individual who the parole board pretty much violates their rights during the course of a hearing. And that has created a problem because the parole board is known to thumb his nose at the courts. The court may order a new hearing and the parole board has pretty much done the same thing all over again. And so that's been called the merry-go-round. Some courts have become so frustrated with that merry-go-round that they have held the board in contempt. They have ordered the parole board to pay counsel fees or daily costs to the individual until a new de novo hearing is held that gives the person the full scope of rights at the hearing.
Who appoints the parole board members?
The governor.
Yes.
You know, I feel like we're a little frustrated right now because release aging people in prison started, 3 years ago? And very quickly, we found that there was huge support for this concept of releasing long-termers. The parole board was forced by an executive law change to add to their regulations this forward-looking strategy of looking at risk and needs assessment, in addition to some other things. They finally wrote into their regulations in, I think, May of 2011. They voted them in. In December of 2013, they wrote new regulations to take that law into account. And the community, lawyers, formerly incarcerated people, family members, found the regulations to be toothless. That's the word that Fareed used, and I think it's exactly right. They just added them to a laundry list. It's like what lawyers do with a discovery dump, where you give so much stuff that the other side can never go through it. So they made this long list. So RAP, along with other groups, organized a series of public comments on the regulations, and we got something like, 400 sets of comments. 80% of them were saying these new written regulations don't do it. The parole board passed them anyway, ignored. And since then, we've had appeals that have said, you should be following more the law and not so much your regulations. And yet, we don't have the power of the legal community again to demand, to say to Governor Cuomo, to say to the parole commissioners, you must begin recognizing the desire of the community to staunch the flow, the growth of the number of people behind bars who could be let out, and start releasing people. But the parole board functions, and the only people they seem to listen to are the law enforcement agencies in the state.
Do you have any support of either former law enforcement officials who have spoken out on this, or even current ones?
Yes, we do. You'll see some in the material that I gave you, in that white paper, former DOCS commissioner, former parole board chairperson has actually submitted papers for that report.
It seems to me that this is an instance in which community organizing, which you're obviously doing, and public outcry, humanizing stories of the individuals whose lives have been spent behind bars, is a good approach to take, since legal venues are slim.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we also do need the support, again, of the legal community. And in this white paper, which is called Aging in Prison, Reducing Elder Incarceration and Promoting Public Safety. And the reason it's called that is that the release of elders would promote, not just not challenge, but would promote public safety, because it would free up the funds to go back into communities, as opposed to going into, chains and bars and overtime for prison guards. And it would adjust the system. It would begin to correct this horrible problem we have in this country of mass incarceration. But in this white paper, we have a paper from the former chairman of the New York Parole Board, Edward Hammack. We have a paper from Brian Fisher, the former head of the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision for New York. And there are other former parole commissioners who have signed amicus briefs saying that the law enforcement community is exerting too much power over the process. And we are trying to focus this through community support and through organizing the legal community and other professional communities to make a demand on the system and on the governor, in addition to passing legislation, which we support, called the Safe Parole Act. But we don't even need to do that to begin to release some of these elders.
We're talking to two former prisoners, Laura Whitehorn and Mujahid Fareed. They are the principal people organizing Release Aging People in Prison, RAP. You just made reference to a paper that you put out. Tell us the name of the paper and how our listeners can get a hold of it.
Well, it's called, the name is a little long. It's Aging in Prison, : Reducing Elder Incarceration and Promoting Public Safety. It was issued this month by the Columbia University Center for Justice, the Center for Justice at Columbia University. And if people go on their website, they can find it. If they go on our website, rapcampaign.com, that's R-A-P as in people, P as in prison, campaign.com, they can find a link to the report. It's quite lengthy.
I'm curious what the rationale from the other side of this issue is. What possible justification can law enforcement and others be making?
I think you would see the answer to that reflected not only in the criminal justice arena, but throughout social systems in this country. this propensity to punish, to extract blood out of those most on the lowest of the social scale. We see it in the welfare system. We see it in the school systems. We see it all over, this propensity to punish. And we argue that this is actually traceable to the institution of slavery.
You use the term decarcerate. It's a wonderful term. That resonates.
I use the term dismantle. And sometimes I have to work with decarcerate because, you know, that's what others use.
You're going for the big picture here.
That's right.
Right.
Let's talk about the big picture, because my opinion, not only does the parole system not work, the whole prison system doesn't work. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be some provisions for really violent people that could hurt you. I mean, that's a different question. But in the main, I don't think the prison system works. And when you say it goes back to slavery, talk about that.
Well, I'm saying that it's not just the prison system. I'm saying it's the whole social system. Marie Gottschalk, she's an authority on this stuff. And she's out of the University of Pennsylvania. She is now elevating the conversation, the narrative, to talk about the carceral system, not just mass incarceration, but the carceral system, which shows that this propensity to punish and this propensity to penalize is reflected not only in prisons, but throughout the society. She is arguing that now, corporations like the American Correctional Association, which is big into making money off of prisons, that they realizing that something is going to be done. They realize something is going to be done because we have this bipartisan, so-called bipartisan concern now about decarcerating, I'll use that term. And that, so them realizing that something's going to be done, it's going to the drawing board, strategizing other ways to continue to make money off of penal processes, such as ankle bracelets, probation systems, and all of that kind of stuff. It's a lot bigger than just prison.
And also, when we talk about it going back to slavery, what happened after slavery when it was outlawed is Jim Crow. And the prison system was a major enforcer of Jim Crow laws. And then during the 70s, when I became political and started, you know, agitating against the war in Vietnam, against racism, I saw leaders of the black struggle being incarcerated, some of whom are still in prison today, some of whom are in New York and fall within this population we're talking about. And then we saw the drug wars, quote unquote, where thousands and thousands of young black people were incarcerated for basically nothing. So we see consistently a system of repression. But, I mean, we've started even to talk, you know, people talk about ending mass incarceration. We do want to end mass incarceration. It was a travesty. It locked up all these young people and older people for nothing. However, if we ended mass incarceration, which is why I think we don't use the word decarcerate so much, the numbers would go down, but the system would still be in place. And the system before the, quote, war on drugs was still overwhelmingly black. And it was still used to repress and destroy black communities, not just repress the people in there, not just affect their families, but affect the entire society. And so the end of mass incarceration is not really our goal. It's a transformation of the kind of ways that we deal with damage in our communities, with violence, with, you know, people breaking the law, whatever. But there needs to be a transformation. And the reason we focus on this thing about the paradigm of punishment is that is a fundamental plank of the system we have now of prison. Because the rule is, if you're black or a person of color, you get fewer second chances. One thing that's going on right now is they're talking about now the big wave of people being arrested for drugs is white. The new heroin plague is affecting white people. So all of a sudden you find legislators talking about, oh, let's use diversion. Let's not put people in prison. What a coincidence. So that's one of the things that we're trying to get to by talking about the why it is such a contradiction to keep in prison people who pose no public safety risk. It's not about public safety.
We started our interview, and we just have a few minutes left, mentioning that Mujahid had not only gotten several degrees but was a jailhouse lawyer while you were inside. Did you assist others in filing claims?
Yes.
And what was there a great need for that, I imagine?
Absolutely. As you probably know, as an attorney, Gideon doesn't extend to civil litigation. And once you're convicted, even habeas corpus is considered civil. And so much of the court proceedings that you'll find coming from people behind the walls, it will be classified as civil actions, and the state is not going to provide representation. So the representation that the people get, the state is basically required to provide law libraries and assistance through law libraries.
And you were transferred how many times in New York State? How many facilities were you in?
Oh, I didn't really count them, but most of the maximum security facilities I spent some time at, and that would probably be about, 15 or 20, and a couple of the medium security facilities I spent some time in.
How did this affect your family? Some of those prisons are like 400 miles
away.
So telephone calls are really expensive.
Right.
Or they were.
There was long periods of time when my fundamental way of communicating was telephone, not visits. So that was when I spent quite a bit of time up near the Canadian border, either directly north or near Buffalo. Visits were far and few in between.
If our listeners are interested in getting involved or learning more, is there a website or resource that they can turn to?
Yes, we have a website where they can get all of the information to engage themselves in this work with us. And the website is RAP Campaign, that's two P's, RAPP campaign.com. And from there, you can get the address of where we do the work, when our meetings are held, and a lot of other information.
And one thing you can find, if you go on that website and you go to About, in the upper right-hand corner, there's a place with a link to sign a petition that we have that's directed to the governor, to legislators, to anyone who has any clout, saying release aging people in prison. It's very basic, and we would like to get 30,000 signatures so that we can bring them to the governor and say, time to do something here.
Well, Laura, we got a lot of listeners, and I can tell you that they're going to help. Mujahid, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate your coming down to the studio and being on Law and Disorder.
And again, thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Raymond Nat Turner is an acclaimed New York City poet whose words, both on the page and stage, are powerful, political, and timely. artistic director of the jazz poetry ensemble Upsurge, Turner is a member of the National Writers Union's New York Local Steering Committee, who recently read at the Harriet Tubman Centennial Symposium. He has appeared at numerous festivals and venues around the globe, from the Monterey Jazz Festival to PanaFest in Ghana, West Africa. Currently poet in residence at Black Agenda Report, Turner has been the opening act for such people as James Baldwin, Cynthia McKinney, radical sports writer Dave Zirin, and Congressman Barbara Lee after her lone vote against attacking Afghanistan. Raymond Nat Turner, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be invited.
Well, we've heard a lot about your performances and your poetry, and we hope to see you in person one day. But we wanted to know, how did you get political?
Oh, my God.
When did you pick up your middle name?
Right.
Well, the short story on politicization is that I grew up in an activist household. My mother was an organizer, an activist in South Los Angeles. She fought to have the public transportation serve South Central L.A.
Yeah.
Then she was one of the founders of the Martin Luther King Jr. General Hospital in Los Angeles. And she was just a general thorn in the side of the established order for a long time. In fact, there was a police killing of a man by the name of Leonard Deadweiler, who was rushing his pregnant wife to the hospital, and once he was pulled over by the LAPD, the officer just essentially just executed him. So there was a call for a big demonstration at Avalon and Imperial down in South Los Angeles, and so my mother went to a group of the most powerful preachers in LA and told them, and I quote, and this came from one of the preachers themselves, that if they weren't at Avalon and Imperial at the appointed hour with their flocks, they would never preach again in Los Angeles. They showed up. The LAPD had said that the march was not going to happen, but it happened, and it happened on a grand scale. And so they got in front of it as if they were escorting it and so forth. But that's the, you know, that's just kind of the way she rolled, basically. And the other thing is that her youth center, the Teen Post, was actually the nucleus for the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party. And Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was her assistant director. And before that, Ray Masai Hewitt, another Panther to be, was her assistant director, and she had hired Bunchy Carter out of the penitentiary, basically. He came right out and became assistant director of an anti-poverty program.
Our kind of woman, in short. A great mother to have.
There's one thing that is really interesting, the intersection that I'm with you all today. Because before this iteration of my existence, I was on the path to go to law school. I wanted to be a lawyer, and I actually, as a young person, would get on the bus and go to the courts and just watch trials, watch cases being put on by lawyers. And I used to watch Johnny Cochran and others, and then subsequently, I got an internship at my cousin's husband's office, which was called the Greater Watts Justice Center, and it was under legal aid, and he was the directing attorney there, and we had people like Lynn Wineglass come through and train attorneys there. Had a guy, Henry DeSouvereaux, and Bill Kunstler may have come through, I'm not exactly sure, but anyway, they were doing some great work, and I would go to court and, you know, prep witnesses at the office and help with investigation and, you know, help with jury selection. I can never pronounce Vordire.
Vordire.
Vordire, yeah. And so long story short, I was really trying to do the work to prepare myself to go to law school and all that. And then we did a two-week trial on a person who was framed by the LAPD, you know, with the typical charges of assaulting an officer, resisting arrest, and so forth, after he was beaten up rather severely by them. And the attorney that I was with, Jonathan Steiner, won the case, and that discouraged me from being a lawyer. I mean, he put on such a dogged defense. I mean, he was threatened repeatedly with being held in contempt of court and et cetera, et cetera. And even they even wanted to throw me out of the courtroom because I laughed when these officers were on the stand testifying, as they call it themselves, and talking about, you know, the defendant flipping them and tripping them. And it just reminded me of the old bad produced Batman series in the 60s, I think it was. So anyway, that's part of what has brought me to where I am. I basically said to myself that if it took that much to get this client off, who was clearly innocent, and he got just a brilliant defense, and I would say, you know, not everyone's going to get that. And I, you know, I just didn't think I could do that. And I said, I want to do something that I could reach numbers of people. And I thought, and then go straight to their hearts. And I thought that would be art. And that's what led me here.
Now, we want to hear you read for us, if you will, in a few minutes. But also, how did you get involved with Black Agenda Report? Because we've had Glenn on several times and are good fans.
And Ajamu Baraka also.
Right.
Okay. Wow. Great. That's an interesting story. I wish, you know, actually, I was sitting out in Oakland, California, and I was feeling, you know, very isolated and marginalized in a certain way. But nevertheless, I was still upbeat and still determined, and because I know I was on the right path.
Just having a momentary minute of reflection.
Yeah. Well, it was after post-election or inauguration of 2009. So, you know, I felt the people around me had lost their minds, had become utterly insane. And so all of a sudden, I'm listening to the radio, and I hear this stentorian voice talking about the very things that were that I believed to be the case at that moment in time. And I said, wow, oh, my God. And then I tuned in the next week at 11 o'clock out there, and he was on again. It happened to be Glenn Ford. And so I started listening to the program religiously, if you will. And the next thing I know, I contacted them. I maybe sent them a piece that I had written. You know, they were enthusiastic about it. And so what happened is that I was asked by them to write a piece in response to one of my heroes' pieces that was kind of tragically, woefully inadequate to express what needed to be expressed. And so I took it up. You know, I never did those kind of things on command or request like that, but I did it. And so then that started our relationship, and I became their poet in residence.
Well, speaking of your poetry, we would love it if you could read to us from Weaponized Condolences of a Warfare State.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, it really comes at the right time.
Yes.
Totally contemporary. With our last show, actually, on ISIS. So thank you very much for doing that for us.
Oh, well, thank you guys for always being consistent and weighing in on the issues, both national and international, by the way. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, yeah, sure, I'll be glad to read it. That's Weaponized Condolences for a Warfare State. Blood, guts, severed heads and limbs litter rubble. Blood has not had time to coagulate. Wall Street piranha cry crocodile tears on terror. Opening bomb bays, their hearts go out, $110,000 a pop. Job creators of ruin gift themselves another war. It could have been Port-au-Prince, Kinshasa, Tripoli, Damascus, Baghdad, Boston, London, New York City. But this time it was the City of Lights. Some of us listen to leaders without legs to stand on, fooling fools and babies. We were briefly innocent, never naive around shocking, awful carnage in our names, crimes against humanity. The hospital bombing Nobel Peace Prize winning war criminal cries, freeze-dried, antifreeze tears. Palestinians feel the burn of white phosphorus in corporate catechism. Yes, we can seamlessly wage endless war and do regime change you can believe in. It's still the new American century and a gold-plated Iron Lady rust in peace, waiting on the wings of a predator drone. She grows impatient to start smearing the paint crimson ivory navy for war. Electoral Lilliputians lost their minds and moral compasses, trading organizing for orgasm with the second coming of Christ. They were once anti-war activists. Now, they're just junkies with seven-year itches, eight-year itches, eunuchs and nuns taking mule dung wafer vows of silence. Worms crawling around searching for imaginary openings to organize on the commander's watch. The world can't wait for them to become clean and sober. The world can't wait for them to quit organizing Halloween parties, parties dressing boogeymen on elephants as the end of the world, war criminals on mules as Mother Teresa, scaring out the vote, helping fuel the Wehrmacht with fear.
Well, that was...
Bravo. That was magnificent.
Weaponized Condolences for a Warfare State by Raymond Nat Turner. Raymond, you're involved in poetry, art, and politics, and you've got an event coming up that I know about, but I wish you'd share that information with our listeners.
Sure. It's called Honor MLK Arts for Arts. The organization that puts on the Vision Fest is doing what they call January Evolving, and the subtitle of the event is Not a Police State and Justice is Compassion. And that's Friday, January 15th, 2016, of course. And I'm on the program at 7 p.m., and there's other performances at 8. John Ebert, a bassist, and then Hammett Blewett and William Parker, Gerald Cleaver with Farmers by Nature is at 9 p.m. And it's at a place called the Abrazo Gallery. It's at 107 Suffolk Street, number 3.5, and that's between Rivington and Delancey Street.
Well, we've only got a few minutes left, but Heidi and I are interested in your current take on things. So give us an idea where you think things are and where they're going and what we could do about it.
Well, one of the things that I think is very, very promising is the events that have unfolded in Chicago, talking about the most recent extrajudicial killing, but actually the response to it, similar to Ferguson, where young activists are taking the lead. And I think that's such an important development because they gain vitally essential political experience of their own, you know, not textbook experience, not just mentoring from older activists, which those things are very important as well, but it's nothing that really beats or surpasses really on-the-ground experience, and they're gaining that. They're becoming really sophisticated in terms of struggle, just the way they conducted their dealings with Rambo Emanuel. You know, he called for a meeting to split the activists off, and they were savvy enough and wily enough to know that that's what he was doing, attempting to do, and they refused the meeting. And they've been out there consistently. And so I think that's one of the more promising things, as was Ferguson and Baltimore. And I think supplanting of what Black Agenda Report likes to refer to as the Black misleadership class, but I'm kind of, as they would say, old school. I just call them the Black bourgeoisie, Black petty bourgeoisie, that leadership that sold out, misleadership. They don't hold as much sway as they once did. I mean, I think it's palpable and anecdotally, and there's evidence of that. And so I think those are some of the more promising things. And I think the thing that would be most gratifying is to see the merging. And there is this happening where these movements, some of the activists are overlapping. They're involved in these various movements, and they're going back and forth, and they're seeing the connections and strengthening the links and so forth. And I think that is that is totally exciting. I'm totally wired up about that, fired up about it, rather, you know.
Well, Raymond, you've brought a lot of those connections together for us in your poetry, and we are so honored to have you on Law and Disorder, and hope that we can invite you back on to share more with us.
In the meantime, we'll see you on January 15th at 7 o'clock at Bravo at 107 Suffolk Street. That's January 15th, 7 o'clock, 107 Suffolk Street, to hear Raymond Nat Turner perform.
In New York. Thank you, Raymond.
Thank you. All right, you guys take care. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye. Chicago attorney Flint Taylor is a partner in the People's Law Office. He and Jeff Haas represented the estate of Fred Hampton when the Chicago police assassinated the leader of the Black Panther Party years ago. Flint was the lead attorney in many cases involving the torture victims of Commander Burge on the southwest side of Chicago. He's active in the National Lawyers Guild Police Accountability Project, and he's been practicing police misconduct law for 45 years. He joins us to talk about the firing of Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy and the situation of the movement against police brutality in Chicago. Flint Taylor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be with you again, Michael.
Well, Flint, last week was a big week with the Chicago Superintendent of Police Gary McCarthy getting thrown under the bus by Rahm Emanuel. And I wanted to ask you the background to that, but I just wanted to make one observation. And I'm from Chicago. My mother was born in Chicago. Our family goes back in Chicago 100 years. And even talking with my grandfather, I mean, there's been a consistent 100 years of corruption in that place. Lenny Bruce, who performed in Chicago, used to say Chicago was so corrupt it was thrilling. And the investigation of the Laquan McDonald murder and the cover-up is just further evidence of it. But this time, it looks like the cops aren't going to get away with it. And I wanted to ask you what the background was to the McDonald murder and the cover-up, and now the firing of the head of the police force. What's going on in Chicago?
Well, I hope you're not going to have me talk about the 100 years of police corruption here. That would take more than the time we have.
We'll do a PBS special on that.
We could do a couple of those. But the McDonald case, the young man was killed, about 15 months ago by the Chicago police. One officer emptied 16 bullets into the young man, and while several other police officers stood by. And it was on video, but the city of Chicago and the police department were successful in keeping that video under wraps for 15 months. And during that time, of course, when the shooting took place, it was at a time when the mayor was very vulnerable in the primary election running up to the mayoralty. So the last thing that he and his lawyers and the police department wanted was to have a video similar, if not worse, than the Tamir Rice and Eric Garner cases come to light at a time when he was trying to bring back the African-American vote after alienating it so completely by closing 49 schools in the black and poor communities. So there was a real reason to keep this video under wraps. And so what they did was they approached the family or the mother of the young man, Laquan McDonald, and offered him a settlement before his lawyers ever filed a lawsuit. Very unusual. I can tell you in 45 years that I've been fighting police brutality and torture cases here, I've never had that happen. But it was in their interest, and they then got the mother and the lawyer to agree to a protective order and to not announce the settlement until after the mayoral election. So that all happened in April, and they announced the settlement, $5 million, and referenced a videotape. The Corporation Council told the City Council in getting the approval of the settlement that there was a video and that this was a cold killing, and a bad killing, as they like to call it in the police department. But then this video was still under this protective order, and the family or the mother was also said she didn't want the video to come out because she didn't want to see it. So that's where it was at, and then several different media people sought the video under Freedom of Information Act. And finally, a couple of weeks ago, a Cook County judge ordered the, over the objection of the city, ordered the city to produce the video. Now, this is 13, 14 months after the killing, and all of a sudden the city and the investigators from the state's attorney's office and the feds, who are also looking into it, are looking down the barrel of a public release of a video that's going to show a cold-blooded murder. So our wonderful state's attorney, Anita Alvarez, who is a disciple of Richard Devine, who is a disciple of Richard Daley. In other words, there's an unbroken string of state's attorneys who are in the pocket of the police department, whether it be police torture that they covered up or, in this instance, a police killing. And so for 13 months, this state's attorney had done nothing, but the video was going to be released in 5 days, and so on the fourth day, she returns a murder indictment to try to get out in front of the video coming out and making her look like a complete cover-up fool for not having indicted this officer for murder. And so the video, which I'm sure most people by now have seen, just shows the young man kind of half walking, half running down the street, going past the cops. He has a little knife in his hand. It's not even, he's not menacing it at all. And then you see him twist around as the bullets hit him. And then you see a pause for several seconds. He's writhing on the ground. And then you see a puff of smoke as this officer puts another 10 to 15 shots into the young man to make sure he's dead. It's just, you know, it's terrible. It's a terrible murder, and for some reason the audio's missing on the video, and so you don't hear all the pop pop pops. And it turns out there was a complete video of all of the action coming from a Burger King across the way from where it happened. And then there's a second video showing the cops going into the Burger King and monkeying with the video for like 2 or 3 hours. And supposedly now there's like 86 minutes of that video, the Burger King video, missing. And so it raises really intense questions about what those cops were doing for 3 hours with the files of the Burger King video. And the Burger King guy who runs the Burger King says that the cops deleted the files.
So let's talk about what the movement did, because, you know, there are people in motion way before this around the question of torture that you've been working with, the community, the aldermen. How did they get this police chief fired? And talk about the demonstrations on the Miracle Mile.
Well, as you know, and as we've talked about previously on this show, there was a very strong movement behind reparations for men who were tortured by John Birch here in the city of Chicago, who did not have any legal recourse. Ironically, at the same time they were covering up this video, they were negotiating with us to have this reparations package, which was compelled by the political realities of the mayoral election and the fact that there was a very strong, predominantly young and African-American movement here. Black Lives Matter, BP Black Youth 100, We Charge Genocide were demonstrating then, this was this past spring, for reparations. Well, that same set of organizations, along with the Chicago Teachers Union, SEIU, other progressive organizations, all came together over, quote, Black Friday, unquote, to disrupt or to stop shopping on the Magnificent Mile on North Michigan Avenue. And what they did was, in their protest, they locked arms and they blocked entrance into stores such as The Gap and other places that are up there by the Water Tower Place, which is a big shopping center, a glitzy shopping center, a high-rise shopping center in Chicago. And they've got a lot of publicity, and their demands were primarily get rid of the police chief, get rid of the state's attorney Alvarez, change the culture of the police department, and the government appointment of a special prosecutor to prosecute this cop, because we all know that in the instances like the Rekia Boyd case, where a young girl was killed by the cops, that the state's attorney has a propensity, if they do charge, to undercharge and then to lay down and lose the case. So those were some of the demands.
Flint, we've run out of time. I'm going to have to say goodbye to you. We'll get you back on with more updates on this story. It's tremendous what's going on in Chicago. Flint, you're a partner in the People's Law Office. You handled the estate for Fred Hampton after the police assassinated him back in the 60s. You've been in the movement against police brutality ever since, and it's really a pleasure and an honor to have you on Law and Disorder. We look forward to speaking with you again shortly. You take it easy.
I will, Mike, and just I just will point out that this past week was December 4th, and in 1969, of course, that was the anniversary of the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark here in Chicago.
Thank you, Flint.
Take care now, Mike.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.